Thank you for listening to PRN.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you might find.
Welcome to Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle, your host. You can find out about me at johnlabelle.com and I blog at visionarycreativity.com. On Visionaries, we talk about creativity in the arts, sciences, technology, culture, and spirituality, and about how we can enrich the world and ourselves by tapping into the energies of the cosmos. You can hear us on PRN.FM every Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can find our shows in the PRN archives. So if you go to PRN.com, click on Schedule, click on Visionaries, you'll find our past shows. On Visionaries, we talk with some of the most interesting people in the world and about the worlds they're creating for the future. Our special guest today is Bob Walter, President and Executive Director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation, which you can find online at jcf.org. We'll be talking about Joseph Campbell, and since Bob was Campbell's last editor and publisher, I thought he would be ideally suited to help us understand this scholar of mythology. So, Bob, welcome to Visionaries.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be with you.
Great. So we'll get more about your background and more, but let's start with, who is Joseph Campbell and why are we talking about him?
Good question. Well, Joseph Campbell was a writer and a teacher. He called himself a comparative mythologist. He taught at Sarah Lawrence for about 50 years. In the 1940s, he wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which influenced a lot of creative individuals over the years, although it remained a less than well-known tome until after his death. Joe died in somewhat obscurity in the late 1987, just about in October, so we're coming up on the 30th year of his death. Hmm. Posthumously, a series of conversations he had with Bill Moyers over the last 3 years of his life were edited by Bill into a series called Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. And that aired in May of 1988, became something of a phenomenon. It was aired again and again over the years, and initially, though, picked up by three radio stations. It rolled out gradually over a number of months until it was a nationwide program. And it's become one of the most lucrative programs for public broadcast, and they've used it for all kinds of fundraising purposes. Plus, they were early contributors to the production fund that Bill Moyers used to produce the program, so its success has enriched them as well. But money aside, what it did is it created a conversation around the idea of mythology in a very broad sense. So not simply dead gods and heroes, but belief systems that move individuals and cultures and have moved those individuals and cultures over time. So Joe's embrace was very, very wide, and it influenced numbers and numbers of filmmakers and folks working in other creative media, and the result is that kind of this strange thing that in the matter of about 30 years, Joe went from being a writer who's wrote a lot of books, but in the last year of his life earned $6,000 in royalties, which is hardly a princely sum for all the books he had in the market at that point. Now, Joseph Campbell's something of a brand name. People make reference to his aphorisms, make references to his perceptions on different phenomenon that have existed over time. Quotes from him appear in major films, and The Hero with a Thousand Faces has continued to sell very, very well. It was named by Time Magazine one of the 100 most influential books of the 20th century. So, Joe has become a cultural touchstone, if you will, posthumously. He began as a scholar really interested in why there are certain patterns and ideas that appear universally around the world throughout time and yet always manifest themselves in different ways.
So Bob, let's to give people unfamiliar with this story a real quick handle, describe the pattern described in Hero with a Thousand Faces, its role in Star Wars, and that famous memo at Disney.
Chris Vogler's memo, yes. I think it was Universal, but be that as it may. What Joe postulated in The Hero with a Thousand Faces is something he called the hero's adventure or the hero's journey. And it's a kind of algorithm, if you will, or a pattern that we all know from our own lives, but that has been encapsulated in the heroic stories and myths that have come down to us of great figures in literature, religion, cultural history. In essence, what it is that the individual is in a quotidian reality, a day-to-day reality, a village culture, if you will, that where something's wrong, something's missing, something's not quite right. And so for one reason or another, he's called to adventure or pushed into an adventure. He crosses into another dimension, crossing a threshold into another dimension. And that part of this journey is called separation. So he's separated from his day-to-day reality, thrust into another reality, a hyper-reality, if you will, a reality where he meets adversaries and he meets helpers and he undergoes various trials and adventures in order to find something called the boon. Now, the boon may be nothing more than a story. It's not necessarily a widget or an object, but it's something that is the key to what was missing in the world that the hero left. Then armed with the boon in this initiation phase, the hero then returns. So it's separation, initiation, which is the big umbrella for all those adventures and misadventures, and then returning back to the world from which he came to complete the journey, to bring back the boon, where in some cases the hero is praised and lifted up as a cultural icon. In other cases, the hero is without profit, and in worst cases, is killed.
So let's you know, do the drill where, so we're in ordinary reality. Luke Skywalker's at the farm, or Jack of the Beanstalk is living impoverished with his mother. There's a call to adventure. The little hologram that says, "Obi-Wan, help me." And Jack throws the beans out the window. And then there is this journey to another realm, so departing from the transition at the bar with the weird creatures, Luke Skywalker takes off for space, or Jack climbs the beanstalk, and then there's the hero helpers. They could be little creatures in the fairy tales, or C-3PO and R2-D2 in Star Wars, and then there's reconciliation with the father. So the giant had killed Jack's father, or it turns out that Darth Vader is Luke's father, and then a return to enrich the world, destroy the Death Star, and help the just cause of the rebels. So we sort of, if anybody is aspiring to be a screenwriter, there it is. There's your next screenplay.
Well, and to pick up on what you referred to earlier, John, one of the explosions of the hero's journey in cinema was Chris Vogler, who was reading scripts at Universal, I believe it was, but he wrote a memo to the people who were reading scripts on his behalf, which became kind of infamous. I can't quote it exactly, but the essence of it was that this is a pattern that's in all good films, and he more or less instructed them to look about a third of the way in, if read around in that section, if they didn't have something that was akin to a call to adventure, then they didn't need to read anymore. And they went to the end, and there was no sort of return, and that was again a problem. And don't waste your time. That he turned into it made the rounds of the various studios, and was turned into a book called The Writer's Journey, published by Michael Vesey's publications. So, it really became a guide. And another place you see it a lot, where it's a kind of Bible, is in gaming, video gaming particularly.
Cool. So my guest today on Visionaries is Bob Walter, president and executive director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. And We're talking about Joseph Campbell, one of the 20th century's leading cultural figures. Campbell lived from 1904 to 1987, and he did many lectures, wrote many books. We're going to sort of get to all of them during the course of this interview and help people who have maybe heard of Joseph Campbell but don't really have a sense of where to penetrate into the work. You know, Bob, I was lived in New York from the 60s on, and I would go to the 8th Street bookstore on 8th Street between 5th and 6th. That was the cultural touchstone of New York. And there was this whole shelf of books by this guy, Joseph Campbell, and I could not penetrate them. I didn't know where to start. They looked, you know, the books we'll mention later, Mass of God, they're like 700-800 pages each, and there are four of them, and they kept coming, more of them kept coming out, because I guess this is when they were, you know, being published. I just didn't know how to deal with this. And then one day somebody said, you know, that guy, Joseph Campbell, he just retired from Sarah Lawrence, and he's lecturing at his wife, Jean Erdman, as a dancer, and she has a loft on 5th Avenue, 14th Street, and he lectures there. And I don't know how, without an internet, I found it, but I think I was there at the second round of lectures and went to all of them ever since. So this is a figure who has influenced many, many people. I guess if you go to the Wikipedia page for Joseph Campbell, you'll see references to his cultural influences. So, Bob, any of those come to mind?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that you just sort of touched on briefly there, John, is that Joe studied abroad for a while. He was very influenced by a lot of Germanic writers and thinkers. And so his prose style when he was writing tended to be Germanic and heavily poetic. He would argue that myths are metaphors and poets work with metaphors. And to get that quality across, he uses a lot of poetic metaphor in his writing, and he uses long, complicated Germanic sentences. Read slowly, they make perfect sense, but when you first encounter them, especially in today's time when we're used to very, very brief messages, it's very simple for one's eyes to kind of glaze. A book called Myths to Live By is a place of entry that I suggest to a number of people because of the fact that those were drawn from early talks he gave at Cooper Union. And when Joe talked, lectured, spoke, he had a very different style than when he wrote. It was much more direct. It was more whimsical, if you will. He was loved to throw in humorous asides. And the range of essays in Myths to Live By are all drawn from these talks that he gave for general public at Cooper Union. So that's a great place of entry, and it shows the breadth of his thinking through various subjects. Another place.
Let's stay there for a minute. That's one of my favorites. And despite the fact it was in the 60s, I think he ends with going to space and, you know, what that means as the new adventure for humankind. And also, the chapters in the book are short, and you can read them in any order. So you don't have to sit down and commit to a long book. You can sort of flip through them. I'm using it right now with my students, and Bob is a publisher, so I'm going to say something he won't be happy with, but you can often find books like this for a few pennies plus shipping used on Amazon if the current price is too much. But they're all affordable. And
well, Myths to Live By, we also have out as an e-book, John, and it's reasonably priced. We don't actually publish the original. The original was published in 72, and that's the reason for the conclusion when he's just beginning to contemplate this idea of Earthrise in the late 60s when we finally had an image of the Earth floating in space. And this was a seminal image in Joe's mind because it reinforced the fact that the only viable tribe was the tribe of the planet, that the planet was this blue marbles floating in space. And that's really one of the in the penultimate chapter in Myths to Live By, when he's contemplating the impact that that's going to have on our cultural history and the stories we pass on.
Great. And then also there's a lot in that book about East and West, and we don't want to oversimplify, but
right.
there is a lot there.
Mental
too.
Health is another subject he touches on, difference between, you know, if you will, mythology and madness, schizophrenia.
Well, another thing that was just happening then was LSD, and so he's sort of interested in that, right?
Right, right. There's a chapter on that, although he was... he said he knew something happened in the 60s because there was an extra zero on his royalty checks.
Right. He was a very straight person. Always wore a suit and tie.
Exceedingly. People would ask him questions about experiences in alternate reality, and he would say, well, that's really very interesting. And he might find a parallel in literature, but not in his own experience.
So the famous phrase is someone... You know, that this was also a time in the 60s and 70s when people were getting gurus and meditating, and they would say to Joe, what's your practice? What kind of meditation do you do? And he would respond, go ahead.
I underline sentences in books.
Right.
The other one was what they would say, oh, Mr. Campbell, I'm just so inspired. Do you have a special diet? And he would say, absolutely. And then they would say, what? And he would say, Glenlivet and rare roast beef.
Right. He was
an iconoclast in his own way. You know, John, another place that I would point people to, which is also available as an e-book, is a Joseph Campbell companion. My name's not on it, although I will proudly say that I really made the book. And it's snippets from different... You can dip into it almost anywhere you want. You don't have to start at the beginning and read through, although if you do, you'll see that there's a very much of a through line. But we've woven together pieces from his lectures and from the array of books that he has. So if an idea or an image or a paragraph or a thought strikes you, it's referenced where you can go to read more about that, because this is, if you will, a pastiche of key ideas and expressions that Joe used through the range of his work.
So I think it'll come through during this hour that there are several Joseph Campbells, you know, more scholarly, more self-help or whatever. And if you're interested in Campbell and mythology for how it might impact your life, how it might help you in your life, The Joseph Campbell Companion is probably the best book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it gives you a wide, wide range of his thinking on a number of areas. A lot of pithy aphorisms that have made their way around the web actually originated in that book. I mean, they found their way into that book, although they were embedded in other texts that he wrote.
Right. And so what do you think of... The power of myth as a way to get started with Campbell.
I think that's a great way, too. I mean, most people start out by listening or watching the shows.
And then there's also a book that transcribes
book.
It, right?
But the book is a little has more a little bit more in it than the shows. It's not a literal transcription of the shows. There were 27 hours that they filmed, and there are 6 hours that were ultimately aired. So the book has goes into a little bit more detail in certain areas than it's not an actual literal transposition of what's on the tape.
So,
but you really get a sense of the man and his penetrating humanness from watching The Power of Myth.
Right. So we've been talking about Joseph Campbell. My guest is Bob Walter. We'll go more into his background in a minute. But we want to, Campbell wrote books and he lectured. And if, you know, when I read Campbell, because I was able to hear the lectures, I sort of hear his writing in his voice. So let's play a few minutes of Campbell lecturing so that our audience can sort of have a sense of what we're talking about.
Wonderful.
The mythological symbol serves four main functions, as I pointed out last week. The first is that of relating you to the ultimate mystery of existence. Existence is mysterious, and that's the wonder of it. It is monstrous, and that's the marvel of it. The second thing the mythological imagery does is present a total image of the universe. But that total image of the universe must be up to date. A religion that carries a symbol system that is 4,000 years old is not going to turn anybody on. It's got to be in relationship to this fabulous universe that we experience today. In that sense, our traditional religions have dropped off. How about the Orient? Anyone who has read any of the Oriental myths and images of the universe has read of a cosmos with galaxies and galaxies, in fact, the cosmos that we have. Furthermore, that imagery is simply to relate you to the marvel of the universe. Whereas in our tradition, the universe is simply the cloak of a divine being who is outside of it. In the Orient, the divinity is right in the universe itself. The third function of a traditional mythology is to validate and maintain a certain social order, this specific social order in which you're functioning. The social order that is represented in our tradition is quite archaic. We are in flux as far as our morals are concerned. The problems of today are not those of the first and second centuries BC. They're totally different. And those commandments and so forth that we carry with us as luggage just don't convince. And anyone who stands up to talk about them is just not talking to today. Our society is secular, not religiously based. The order of law is not divinely inspired. It is arranged by people reasonably sitting down and saying what would be a reasonable aim for life and how do we achieve it, what kind of institutions would achieve it. So there is a secularization of our society, a secularization of our universe, and two of the functions of mythology have been taken over by the secular sciences. The fourth function is the psychological one of carrying a person through the crises of his life. And that's now the function of psychology. Clergymen are going to psychoanalysts to learn how to carry on their pastoral function of advising people in their psychological development. So, just as for the American Indian, the buffalo dropped away, and with it their public social mythology, so for us. The world has moved past and our mythology has dropped off, and we are turned inward, and the Oriental people are the ones who are teaching us how to turn inward in this adventurous quest of finding again those images in ourselves which the society can no longer render to us.
Well, so that's a sense of Campbell's voice. Let me just, for a moment, talk about what this means to me personally, and that is, I see the mythological traditions that and approaches that I learned from Campbell as applicable to our world today in the sense that our sciences and our modes of understanding ourselves today are manifestations of these four functions. So if we say to awaken and maintain a sense of wonder at the universe, that our science today of billions of galaxies and parallel universes is our current mythology. It's also our science, but in terms of the way it reflects for us personally, it's mythological. The picture of the universe in likewise, and then validate and maintain a moral system. Our moral system is ours today, and we can respect that people in the past had other systems. And finally, to aid the individual in passages through their lives, we have various forms of psychology for that. But when we understand our psychology as simply our mythology, then we can have respect for past similar mythologies. And, for example, Campbell would talk about the arc of one's life as it is seen in Dante, or the stages of one's life in traditional India, and then see those as enriching our own psychological systems.
Well said, John. I think another way that people can really come to understand the impact of mythology in their own lives, at least as Joe understood it. Now, parenthetically, Joe would have referred to a mythology as another person's religion. In other words, for me, it's my faith. For you, it's a mythology.
Right.
We don't share it. When I talk, you know, it's easy to understand Joe's idea about a mythology, particularly if you live in a homogeneous culture. If you lived in the Renaissance, for example, where everything that you did and when you did it and how you did it was influenced by an overarching mythos, a mythology that interpenetrated into every day of your life. Or if you live, for example, grow up in an isolated tribal village where you had no contact with other individuals and other belief systems, we don't live like that. But when you start out with the idea that the mythology is supposed to connect you in such a way that the world is magical and alive and wondrous, how do you get there in today's world, you know? I mean, so I like to think that you build it up the other way, and you start with the psychological, the pedagogic, you know, where am I in my own life? What does that mean? And you make a real connection. You're not 60 trying to be 16 or 15 trying to be 25. You know who you are. You know where you are in your own development. You're comfortable with your own psyche, gender, whatever these different facets of your life and personality might be, and it will change over the course of your life. But if you have that connection, and then you're lucky enough to be connected to a society, to a group of people who share your ideas about the world and about growing and living and so on, and they might likely not be necessarily your biological family or even your proximate neighbors. The world has shrunk in such a way now that we can find people with shared affinities and all over. So let's say you make that connection, and then you do look at what you know, the cosmos, and you come to some kind of peace with the awesomeness of it. You know, it no longer overwhelms you. It's a source of beauty and wonder. You take some pride in the fact that you can hold those concepts in your brain, that you can conceive this. It doesn't intimidate you the same way. You feel connected to the cosmos. You recognize that you're a part of the cosmos, that 90% of you is stardust. All those different metaphors and ways of looking at it. If you get those three connections, then I like to say it's sort of like the old-fashioned slot machine where you get three cherries.
Wow.
And then the gold coins come out. And, you know, then you do have that mystical connectedness. It's not to the specific moment here and now where you're standing, but it is this weave you've made for yourself from the smorgasbord of images, mythological images and symbology in which you're drenched.
So that's why we're advocating for Campbell here, that the ways in which it can continue to enrich your life. We'll get to the more scholarly aspects in a moment, but since you're talking about your life, should mention Campbell was tall, athletic, and a champion athlete. He said he would like to occasionally take out his box of medals and lay them out on the bed and recall he was a champion runner. And if you know the movie Chariots of Fire, about the 1924 Olympics, Campbell says he just missed that Olympics. He was, you know, in a qualifying race. He was off by a hundredth of a second. But that's the kind of person he was. That's the kind of world he lived in. He was a physical presence as much as he was a scholar.
Yes, indeed. And he was, you know, he put himself through college playing saxophone in a jazz band. We put together with some help a couple of years back. We had Joseph Campbell Jazzman, and we went back and we played. You know, we a group of folks got together, professional musicians, and recorded the songs that Joe talked about playing with his jazz band.
Wow!
but when he came back from one of the things that's really interesting when And this is a very telling portrait of Joe. When he died, I was putting together a memorial at the Museum of American Museum of Natural History, and I said to his wife, you know, Jean, what was his favorite music? And she said, I really don't know. And I said, he played in the jazz band. And she said, yes, but when he got back from college, when he stopped, you know, he said at a certain point he needed to make a choice, and he put his saxophone away, and he never played music again.
Mm.
And he never listened to music. And she said when she would sit in the living room of their one-bedroom apartment, the bedroom was his study, and she would be working on a new piece, she would have a little transistor radio that she held to her ear. But if Joe came in and saw her doing this, came in from working in his study, he would say, oh, I didn't mean to bother you. I see you're working. I mean, so... He knew that the music could carry him away, but if it did, nothing else, he'd get nothing else done. And
right.
And he did the similar thing when he let go of newspapers. He never had a television. He scheduled his time because he could easily get in a conversation with someone at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and suddenly they'd still be talking intently at 4 or 5, and the afternoon would have gone.
Wow.
So when you hear about enthusiasm and theos, you know, filled with the God, Joe was enthusiastic about everything he encountered.
So one more bit of Joseph Campbell mythology, and then we'll talk a little bit about Bob. But he studied medieval languages at Columbia University and then went off to Europe to work on them in their native place. And there he discovered James Joyce, modern art, Picasso, Paul Klee, and the psychologists Freud and Jung, and came back to Columbia saying, I want to incorporate this in my PhD work. And they said, you can't do that. So he dropped out, rented a cabin in upstate Woodstock, New York for $50 a year, and bought books. Oh, the stock market had crashed, so nobody had any money. Bought books on credit and read the world's literature carefully, notating in margins and underlying. Bob, how long was he in that cabin?
5 years.
5 years of just reading 9 hours a day.
Yep.
And he says, I discovered if you were a handsome young man, you could live without money.
he was a charming dinner guest.
Right.
Charming dinner guest. And you know what he would read, John? He would make notes in the margin, underline things, but then he would also take parallel longhand notes, and when he was done with the book, he might have 20 pages of notes written in whatever the language of the book was. If he was reading a French book, his notes were in French. If he was reading a German book, his notes were in German. And then he would reread his notes, and he would boil it down to 3 pages, and then he would boil it down to 1 page. So if anyone goes and looks at his reading notes in the archive, in the Joseph Campbell archive, in the papers, you'll see that for a given book, he may have 20 pages reduced down to 3, reduced down to 1.
So, Bob, for any scholars in our audience, where do they find the archive?
Well, this is an interesting piece, John. The archives have Campbell's library and archive and papers and everything have been at Opus Archive and Research Center, which is on the grounds of Pacifica Graduate Institute in Carpinteria, New York. Carpinteria, California.
Okay. And as I recall, there's a beautiful room there sort of set up the way he had his library at home set up. And he described it as being inside the sphere of the Earth and then looking out at a map on the sphere so that if Europe was in front of you, then you go to the right, you get Russia, and then right and down, you get Asia, et cetera.
That's exactly how he had his own library set up, John, but I have to say one thing, and that is that when the books were moved, Joe had moved from New York to Hawaii a few years before he died, and we were working on the historical atlas, so some of it, the books were in Hawaii, some were in New York, and some were, in fact, with me. And the unfortunate thing is that the person who got all these together never experienced or understood the way Joe had arranged it. So the library there is beautiful and does have all of his books and things in it, but that wonderful order that he had is gone.
Which is
a shame, because it really was. I mean, I could stand in the middle of his study, and I knew exactly where to look to see if he had a particular volume or a particular reference.
Right. So our guest today is Bob Walter, president and executive director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. So Bob's one of the more interesting people I know, and besides working with Campbell, he's a Jesuit. How do you pronounce that? Noivate?
Well, I was a Jesuit novice for a while.
Okay.
I was in a Jesuit novitiate for about 18 months.
Okay, and then he got his undergraduate's degrees from Northwestern and an MFA from Stanford, helped create and inaugurate the American Theater Institute in Aspen, was a consultant to the board creating CalArts in California, and was a founding faculty fellow at that school. And so, Bob, what else do you do?
John, I think that one of Joe's famous phrases is, when you follow your bliss, doors will open for you where there were no doors for anyone else. And he was also fond of quoting Schopenhauer and saying, when you reach a certain point in your life and you look back, it reads like a novel that no one else could have written. When I look back on my experiences, I know that I've had several different careers. When I veered off a career path and seemed to go at right angles to it, the people who were my peers on that path kind of scratched their head. And yet, for me, this was indeed sort of following my bliss, or trying to listen to the call of the universe. It's not so unusual, perhaps, today for people to have an array of careers. I was a high school trustee, just stepped down recently, and we learned that kids we were graduating would have 7 different careers by the time they reached the age of 65.
Right.
I think, though, that this was one of the reasons that Joe and I connected so much, because, I mean, Joe had been his wife Jean Erdman's production manager. He'd grown up around dancers and performance.
Hang on just a sec.
Yeah.
You mentioned his wife. So Jean Erdman, his wife, was a student at Sarah Lawrence of Martha Graham, part of her dance company, and then started her own dance company. So she's one of the famous modern dancers.
Yeah, she's one of the founders of what we think of as modern dance. A lot of the pillars of modern dance, Eric Hawkins, Merce Cunningham, so on, were in her company. She was in Martha Graham's original company and went on to, create what she called Total Theater, which was a combination of dance, spoken word, music, mask, costume. So Joe had, she was the first woman to solo dance around the world. Joe accompanied her, and he was Mr. Erdman. I mean, he was her stage manager.
Yeah.
Joe was born and raised Roman Catholic and served Mass until his early 20s. We had this Roman Catholic background, with my having come through a Catholic Jesuit education and gone into the Jesuits. We both shared this performing arts side. I had done a whole bunch of writing did a multimedia publication at CalArts with some of the folks from Fluxus and others, and Joe was a writer. So these different areas that of experience that we'd had, I found out that we had a lot of the same experiences in different times, in different venues. And this was not, when we started working together, this was not at all unusual to him. He didn't think this was different.
Right. So, Bob, you left out your theater background. So tell us about your theater background.
Oh, well, I started, I had several companies. My undergraduate and graduate degrees were in theater. Not at that time, I wasn't aspiring to a career in commercial theater. I was doing what I wanted to call secular rituals that would bring communities together. I was sort of steeped in a rock and roll ethos and wondering why that dynamic engagement I didn't see in other arenas. So that was my work, was environmental, multimedia theater. And then I hit New York and started working with Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy. I did about 9 shows with them, and was the production manager for the Repertory Theater Lincoln Center when it turned over to Joe Papp's organization, and stage managed the Royal Shakespeare Company on Broadway. And so it was a very schizoid kind of thing. I would come back to the West Coast to do these large multimedia productions. I did one off Broadway, but then I was earning my dollars in the commercial theater, helping other people realize their visions. So I went most of the 70s. I was in the professional theater, and that's when I was hanging out, when I was not on the road with Jean, and helping her do a bit of tech stuff at the Open Eye Theater, which was her theater company that followed the studio that you mentioned earlier, and Joe was the chairman of the board there. So I had a fairly rich theater career until I started working with Joe in 78, and then we ended up starting a publishing company because no one would publish his books.
See, now the reason I'm doing this radio show is I know people like Bob, and I say, wow, this has to get out there. So back to the books, since you just mentioned that. So we've been talking about mythology, maybe in a bit of a kind of self-help, New Age kind of way, Follow Your Bliss, and then the Joseph Campbell Companion is a really will probably speak to you about how myth can inform and enrich your life. But there's another whole aspect to Campbell's approach. And after doing The Hero with a Thousand Faces, in which he looks at many cultures and sees a similar pattern of the hero journey, he then does The Masks of God, in which he looks at different cultures and sees what's different about them.
Right.
So it's in 4 volumes, and the primitive mythology, Oriental mythology, Occidental mythology, and creative mythology, which is the modern age since, say, since the Renaissance. And the only person I know, I have to confess, I probably read about a quarter of them, but my mother read the whole thing. She said it took 4 years. Each book took a year to read, then read the footnotes, then follow through about the books and the footnotes, and then reread for each one. So anybody out there who wants a college education in 4 books, well,
John, you know, I want to jump in here with one other thing, because you go right to the heart of a criticism that has haunted Campbell. Because The Hero with a Thousand Faces was so well-received, and because he edited a whole bunch of Jungian material, including the Papers from the Aranus yearbooks and the Portable Jung, he got tarred with this brush of being a universalist. And, you know, in the very beginning, as he wrote Hero and as he worked with the early Jungian material through the Bollingen Foundation, that's what he was focused on, absolutely. But the question that immediately came to his mind is, if these things are universals, why are they so differently expressed? And from that point on, the rest of his work was about that. So you speak of the 4-volume Mass of God. I mean, you can think of those being, you know, like he sliced it, East-West, Oriental, Occidental, and he sliced it, primitive, early, pre-literate, and creative, post-Renaissance, post-literate. And that didn't work. he still couldn't get his arms around it. That's what gave rise to the project that we started, which was left unfinished, which is the Historical Atlas of World Mythology. And he went back to German anthropologist Adolf Bastian, who said there are these elementary ideas, elementary Gedanken, but the only way we can know these universals is through Volker Gedanken, which is folk expression. They have to take on the garment or the iconography of a given culture in order to find expression. And so what made those expressions different? In the historical atlas, you have the answer to the riddle in the title, and that is historical and atlas. Atlas first, meaning that the stories, always the mythologies, the images are always tied to the landscape, which is why if you look at the stories of a desert culture in the Middle East, you will find them similar to the stories of a desert culture in Africa or in the high plateaus of South America. And if you look at a jungle culture in the Amazon, you'll find those stories are very similar to stories of people living in the Congo. Similarly, if you look at stories of people who live by the sea, wherever they might live, you'll find similarities. So the stories are tied, were originally tied to the landscape, so the atlas. So the landscape helps define it. And the second one is the phase of cultural development. Now, he kind of got close to that with primitive and creative mythology, but for the atlas, he took Leo Frobenius's four categorizations, and he said the culture is either primitive hunters and gatherers, or they're early agrarian culture, or they're a high culture with hierarchical priests and pyramids and a celestial navigation, things in relationship to the unfolding cosmos, or they are post-Renaissance, which, you know, they are humanistic, they are the psychology of man. So that was where he was, that's what we were working on. The Atlas started out as one volume, then became two volumes, then became four volumes, then became four volumes in multiple parts. So he kept unfolding it, but unfolding it around these two poles, the historical phase of the culture's development on the one hand, and on the other hand, the landscape in which the culture was grounded.
So I, in scholarship, I'm very impatient with a lot of what I see in the histories of cultures and stuff like that because it lacks these insights. And so, Bob, if someone is interested in someone detail of what you were just speaking about, do I understand you have some of the atlas available online?
We just started because it was a large, oversized, growing book. Yes, we have. We're releasing sections of them as e-books, as shorts. So we're breaking out the individual pieces because that was the only way we could figure out to get it out there. It'd be almost economically impossible to print a book, to print books of this size in any discernible quantity. So we've reformatting into an electronic format.
Now, there's one other thing we have to cover. And that is, earlier we played about 4 minutes of Campbell speaking, and I'm a real addict of his lectures. And Bob, with the Joseph Campbell Foundation, has made many, many hours of this available. So, Bob, tell us about the lectures, how and where they were recorded, and how we can get
sure.
a hold of them.
When Joe died, he had a box of tapes of various kinds on his closet shelf where when anyone sent him a recording of a lecture that he'd done, it went in that box. So I look at it. We had wire spools that we had eight track tapes that recorded, you know, single tracks in different directions.
My parents had a wire recorder, and the wire used to get out of the spool and go winding down the spindle.
yes. Well, so what we decided to do early on is we started to get those and gather them, and then also get tapes from places we knew he talked in Earth. And we logged about, I think, 1,100 discrete items. Now, in some cases, we also had like flyers from lectures he'd done or notes, and we were able to reach out to the institution. In some cases, they had it. And then we began very early. George Lucas let us use a facility at Skywalker Sound, and we installed a technician that was the foundation paid that they found for us. And he began to run the, we had to get a variable speed reel-to-reel tape recorder, among other things, where he could adjust for the, and sometimes the tapes had to be baked, and sometimes they had to be cooled, and often they'd go one time through the tape head, and then there'd be a pile of emulsion. We got them all we got as much as we could that was critical, digitized at that point. We eventually moved to digital audio tape, and the vision was that we would cull these, and we would release them in three series, the early talks from his middle years and from his later years. So we call them Series 1, Series 2, and Series 3. Series 1, we began to release on cassette at that point and then moved to CD. And now everything is available electronically. Series 1 is all out. Series 2, we're just about to release the sixth and final volume in that, and Series 3 is laid out and will roll out over the next couple of years. There'll be about 95 lectures in this completed series. The rest of them, as we go through, we are choosing the best. I mean, Joe frequently would give the same lecture several times over the course of a given year, over the course of several years. So we're looking for the best statement and high quality. The rest of them, though, will be eventually available on the JCF.org website for people who want to just listen to them. They weren't for whatever reason did not make it into the ultimately released collected audio. But as we, because they're all digital, they will be able to be listened to.
So for people who might be interested, where do they go? Are they on iTunes as well?
They're on iTunes. They're on Amazon. They're on Rhapsody. They're on Spotify. They're on anywhere, any of those. Or you go right to the Joseph Campbell Foundation, jcf.org, and actually we've bundled volumes. You can buy single lectures at all those other places, but we bundled the volumes at a bit of a discount on our site.
Great. Well, I strongly recommend them, and I'm the kind of I can hardly read books anymore. I must have about 40 books on my phone, and and lots of Joseph Campbell. So whether it's walking around town or driving in the car, I'm always listening to something, and Campbell's one of my favorite.
Well, once again, John, you're on the leading edge here. I read an article only 2 days ago. I believe it was in the New York Times, where they talked about the fact that the e-book sales have dropped. Everyone said that traditional books would decline in the face of e-books. They haven't really, but the rising trend are audiobooks. They're up like 35%.
Wow.
So more and more people are doing as you.
Yeah. So, Bob, tell us about the Joseph Campbell Foundation, what resources our listeners can find there, et cetera.
Well, we're coming into the final throes of redesigning our website. The foundation has been, since its inception, a virtual organization, meaning we've had no central office. When I was asked to run it in the very beginning, I said, I'll be glad to as long as I don't have to manage bricks and mortar because I don't have an edifice complex. So we were virtual. We went live with a website in the mid-90s. We're on our third iteration, which is almost done. The website's our sort of virtual home. You'll find all kinds of resources there, including a database you can search for mythological resources. All of Campbell's work is there. There's conversations about and around the material. There's a section on Campbell in popular culture that we've been developing. Soon we're going to break out a timeline, which is just about ready to go live, of his life and where you can go into the timeline to find things. So that's the website. And then we have mythological roundtables on five continents. These are self-organizing groups. Each one is unique to the individuals. Some have been going on for as long as 20 years. And some are new. Some are no more than a dozen people, and others have mailing lists of a couple hundred. Those are, again, all volunteer, self-run by the individuals. Several of the folks who run these roundtables have an informal coordinating council that coordinates the activities of the group. We have a huge social media presence on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, all those different places. It's kind of amazing to watch, John, as you have and as I have over these 30 years, how Joseph Campbell goes from a respected but narrowly read author read by a narrow number of people in different disciplines to a brand name to having a quarter of a million people around the world, liking his work on Facebook and to having the number of people who visit our website and the amount of interest in various cultures and big presence in Brazil, in India, in Tokyo, in Europe. and, of course, all around the United States.
Wow, great. So the first time I went to Campbell's lectures, it was $50, and there were 50 people in the room. And my response was, why isn't everybody here?
Yep.
And so then the last time he lectured in New York before moving to Hawaii, it was $200, and there were 200 people in the room. So it was getting there. But I want to raise a couple of questions that might be occurring to our audience. And in a little booklet I did some years ago for the Foundation on Campbell, at the back, I asked some questions. Are myths socially or biologically determined? And it's, something you can think about. And I think Campbell said both. He said pressure from the organs quite a bit, and why, we see similarities in myth. Do myths reinforce the established power structure? And yes, they do. That's one of the functions of myth, but they also provide the mechanism of opening to new worlds. Do myths refer to the past, ignoring our changing world? And I think we discussed how Campbell was felt that one of the new mythologies would be our going into space. Are all myths one myth? And yes, in Hero with a Thousand Faces, no, in his later work. And then let's just end up with what Campbell meant by follow your bliss.
Okay. I talk about that as, it's a deep Hindu concept about the way that you can come to enlightenment, and that's the root of it. But bliss in that reference is the thing you can't avoid doing. If you're going to be true to yourself, it's the thing you can't not do. And Michael Mee likes to say, Joe really should have said following your blister, because it is not all sunshine and rainbows. In Joe's iteration, Jesus Christ going to the cross was following his bliss. And in fact, in the early Gnostic Gospels, in one rendering, he and his disciples proceed to the crucifixion singing and dancing. So it's the thing that you were fated to do when you were born into this world. It's your unique gift that you need to discover that moves you. It's the current that runs the river. It's that energy force that, if you tap into it, will take you someplace you could not envision. So that's your bliss. It is not, in contradistinction to some of the criticism when Joe died, it is not an apology for yuppie acquisitiveness. It is not a 1980s, self-aggrandizing kind of thing. It is really much closer wrapped up to a sense of duty and of service.
Great. So listen, Bob, we're running out of time. I want to thank you. My guest has been Bob Walter, President and Executive Director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. Find them at jcf.org. And also, I would recommend the fantastic job that a lot of people have done putting together the Joseph Campbell Wikipedia page. And see everybody next week. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, John.